Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Part-Time Genius, a production of Kaleidoscope and iHeartRadio.
Guess what, Mango?
What's that, Will?
All right, well, I know you're a huge Katy Perry fan, right?
Well, not really.
Well, you're at least familiar with the 2017 song she did with Migos called Bon Appetit, right? Like, big one.
No, I don't know.
For real? This is it. We may need to do a different episode. That's fine. I know it's no firework, but the whole song is basically this extended metaphor. You didn't know she was into this, right? Mm. Extended metaphors where Katy Perry is describing herself as a delicious meal in lots of creative ways. And at one point in the song, she says, I'm a five-star Michelin. A five-star Michelin, Mango.
Five stars is really confident.
No, it's not confident. It's ridiculous because the Michelin star rating only goes up to 3 stars, and poor Katy Perry actually didn't realize that.
So musicians don't fact-check their songs?
I know. It's very, very disappointing.
So wait, Will, why does Michelin only use 3 stars and not like 5 or 10?
Well, the Michelin star system is full of all kinds of arbitrary, opaque, and frankly mystifying rules. And it's kind of its whole thing. That's why they do this. And that's what we're getting into in this episode.
Or in the words of Katy Perry, bon appetit.
I knew you were a big fan. Welcome back to Part-Time Genius. I'm Will, and as always, I'm here with my good friend Mango. And somewhere behind that big booth is our pal Dylan, who I think is trolling us because he's decorated that booth with all these posters of I think I see the Pillsbury Doughboy, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, even that character from, what was it, Big Hero 6?
Yeah, Big Hero 6.
Pretty
neat.
He
is definitely trolling us because he's got every other white puffy character from pop culture except the Michelin Man. Also, where did he get so many Pillsbury Doughboy figurines
impressive.
From?
He's impressive. He's very into finding the sales.
Yeah,
so that's probably where he got
really
it.
Goes all out.
Well, I'm really excited to be doing this show together, but I'm curious, what made you think to do this episode on Michelin stars?
So I watched this Bradley Cooper movie on a flight. It's called Burnt. Have you seen it? And there's this whole thing where they're talking about how to spot these like elite reviewers from Michelin and whatever, and they come in pairs and order in specific ways. And I kind of want to see how much of that was true. So that was part of it. Plus, I know your parents are foodies, and they used to have all those menus on their porch from restaurants
they
loved.
Still do.
Yeah, and I just thought it'd be a fun topic.
Yeah, I'm excited to dive in. So why don't we go back to the beginning just to think about where the name comes from? So basically, we're going way back to 1889, and Michelin started out as a tire manufacturing company, which I think a lot of people know, but it was the brothers André and Édouard Michelin, and they took over their grandfather's struggling manufacturing business, and they started producing tires. And they were really clever. So they patented this removable pneumatic bike tire, they invented the first automobile tire, and they even made rubber train tires.
Tires for trains?
That's supposedly why the Paris Metro used to be so quiet. I'd never heard of this before, but just in looking to this, it's pretty neat. And it doesn't screech like New York's. But anyway, in 1889, Michelin debuts their puffy mascot, the Michelin Man, way back in 1889.
Yeah, as Dylan pointed out, looks a whole lot like the Stay Puffed guy from Ghostbusters.
Yep, except he's not made of marshmallows. Mm-hmm. He's actually made of tires. And apparently Michelin tires used to be white. And one day, Edouard looked at this pile of tires and he was like, hey, Andre, if that pile of tires had arms, it would look like a man. See, that's how this stuff comes to life.
Yeah, I mean, I guess anything's a mascot if you put arms on it.
And they had this kind of funny concept for it. They named their tire man Bibendum because that comes from the Latin phrase nunc est bibendum, which means now is the time to drink. Because in these earliest ads, if you look at them, he's actually holding up this goblet of nails and broken glass. Because the whole concept was they wanted to show that Michelin tires were unfazed by obstacles on the road.
So in this super weird scenario, he's drinking nails and broken glass?
Yeah, the tire man. That's what he does.
Okay, so Michelin Man is like this well-fed, indestructible bon vivant, the kind of guy who can eat and drink all day and night and just keep going,
it's impressive.
Yeah,
it's a very French illustration of longevity. Mm-hmm. So anyway, in 1900, Michelin begins publishing these free travel guides to France, and eventually they make guides for other parts of Europe. And it's a pretty smart play because Michelin's basically acting like tourism pioneers. So they're encouraging ordinary people to take longer and longer road trips, as, you know, of course, helps boost tire sales. Mm-hmm. And from the beginning, these tourism road trip guys included restaurant recommendations.
So I guess these early French travelers weren't like eating handfuls of Twizzlers or beef jerky on the
trips. Really missing out. And Michelin was smart about their review system too. The reviews were always conducted anonymously. And so this gave Michelin this extra layer of credibility with customers. They weren't just handing out good reviews to friends. Then you fast forward to 1926 when the stars first began appearing. So this is a quarter of a century later, but at that time, they're all awarded to restaurants in France. And so initially they were just starred and non-starred restaurants. But then in the 1930s, Michelin created the three-star system that remains in place today.
So there's no real reason that it's three stars. They just kind of decided that.
I mean, they're French, so they have to do something a little different. I don't know if you've ever been to a Michelin star restaurant, Mango, a one or a two, or my God, a three Mango?
Isn't Milo's a three-star restaurant?
the fast food burger joint? I think it was two stars, and still they started putting that extra nub of meat on the patty,
yeah,
just a little bonus nub. And then that got them to three. No, actually, I don't think they have any stars, Mango.
So I think what's funny about the whole Michelin star thing is how vague the distinctions are between sort of the one, two, and three-star establishments.
What do you mean by that?
So apparently one Michelin star is awarded to restaurants using top quality ingredients, where dishes with these distinct flavors are prepared to a consistently high standard.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it totally sounds good. And then two Michelin stars are awarded when the personality and talent of the chef are evident in these expertly crafted dishes, and their food is refined and inspired.
Mm-hmm. Well, also sounds good.
Mm-hmm. And three Michelin stars, the highest award is given for the superlative cooking of chefs at the peak of their profession. The cooking is elevated to an art form, and some of their dishes are destined to become classics.
That also sounds good, Mango.
I mean, the system. That's the thing, is they all sound good. I mean, and they also kind of sound the same, right? Like mm-hmm. one star is good, two stars is more good, and three stars is just like more good.
Like, seriously, it's good. Yeah.
So how do you eat a meal and decide that the food is refined and inspired versus, you know, a meal that's an art form?
Right.
How do they even make these judgments?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Mango.
Yeah, it's almost like I set you up.
So the judging is done by anonymous Michelin inspectors, all of whom work full-time and have prior restaurant and hospitality experience. Multiple inspectors dine at a restaurant under consideration, and then they talk about these ratings together. So it's not just one person that's passing judgment on a place after a single meal. Inspectors visit multiple times for different meals with the goal of experiencing the full range of the menu. So it's a really thorough process. And Michelin claims there is, quote, no secret mathematical formula, and that decor, degree of formality, type of cuisine, like all of that, that they really don't matter. Of course, there are five specific criteria the judges use to award stars. Mm-hmm. So here they are. The first is quality of the ingredients. The second is the harmony of flavors. Then you have the mastery of culinary techniques. Fourth is the personality of the chef is expressed through their cuisine. And then the fifth is consistency of the above, but across the entire menu and over time. And it's worth mentioning there's also this thing called the Bib Gourmand designation, and it's given to the most affordable restaurants that offer high value for the money. And I have wondered this before, because you'll notice this in cities. Sometimes it'll be like a diner or something like that that'll end up with a Michelin star. I do think that's pretty cool that they think about it this way. But all of this judging is done completely anonymously, and that just actually seems crazy to me. Like, I don't understand how these inspectors could keep their identity a secret if they're hopping around to all the world's best restaurants multiple times a year.
Yeah, and that's exactly the part I wanted to dig into. So why don't we tackle that after a break?
Sounds good.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Welcome back to Part-Time Genius, where we're talking about Michelin stars and why chefs are so darn thirsty for them. So, Mango, I think you were just about to tell us how the food criticism at Michelin works.
That's right. So in 2009, The New Yorker published this profile of a New York inspector, and it's super fun and cloak and dagger. The inspector's pseudonym was Maxine. And the first really interesting thing is that she said most Michelin executives don't even know who the inspectors are.
Oh, wow.
In fact, inspectors are told to keep their work secret from their friends and even from their parents.
I have to be honest, I don't think I could keep that secret from my parents.
Yeah, I know. I feel like Bill and Paulette would definitely be dining with you and bringing everyone boxes of fancy leftovers. Mm-hmm. But Maxine revealed that she ate restaurant meals about 200 days per year, dinner and lunch, and almost always alone, because inspectors really can't risk being identified through conversations at the table.
I love eating out, and I love eating out at good restaurants, but 200 days a year, I have to, and especially like by yourself most of the time, that kind of seems like torture.
I know. It's almost like work travel. Like as a kid, you think it's going to be so exciting, like on the road and in hotels and stuff. And then you do it for a few months and it kind of loses its charm. But at Michelin, the system is almost set up like this secret service. So Maxine said when she was being considered for the job, she had to eat several meals under supervision of inspectors who operated like spies. And this is her quote: "You never know the name of the person you're meeting. You never know where they're meeting until right before. So they call you up and say, meet me at the corner of XYZ and XYZ.
So dramatic. Like you kind of forget for a second we're talking about food. Like it seems like a national security thing, but it's really like who has the best pork belly.
Yeah. And aspiring inspectors also have to attend a secret Michelin training course in France. And then they have to complete all this additional still anonymous training in another country. And then they do a 3 to 6 month, still very anonymous apprenticeship with a more senior inspector. So another anonymous inspector from a 2017 Food and Wine article did shed a little bit of light on what happens here. He said, "We always order 3 courses, an appetizer, an entree, and dessert, and we try to pick items that are the best representation of the menu, concept, or chef's talents." But of course, despite Michelin's best efforts, in December 2003, there was this big tell-all.
I was hoping you would get to a tell-all.
Yeah, you kind of have to hope for it. So this book comes out from this inspector named Pascal Remy, who was fired after revealing that he'd kept a diary of his career and he planned to publish this book. And so the book is called The Inspector Sits Down at the Table, and it was published in France in April 2004, and it caused a huge stir. One journalist from France called it a storm in a saucepan.
A storm in a saucepan. I kind of love that.
Yeah, it's great, right? It's also a good description of Ruby. But Remy alleged some pretty wild stuff in this book, all of which Michelin disputes. He said that despite publishing new guides with updated ratings every year, Michelin didn't actually visit or revisit every restaurant annually, which is a huge scandal, right? In part because there aren't enough inspectors. Remy wrote that there were only 5 inspectors in all of France as of 2003 when he was writing, which is not nearly enough to cover the country's 10,000 restaurants. Mm. He also said there's some 3-star restaurants which were secretly deemed untouchable. So like under no circumstance could they lose their top rating, even though Remy claimed more than a third of the guide's 3-star rated establishments didn't actually meet the 3-star criteria.
I feel like that's a really bad look for a rating system that's supposed to be, you know, super objective and impartial for this whole history of its existence. Mm-hmm. But when you have something like a Michelin star that's sought after and means so much to these restaurants, there's definitely going to be some fallout from this.
So what are you thinking about right now?
Well, for example, obviously getting a Michelin star can catapult a restaurant into fame and in many cases bring these huge profits. But losing a star, and I'd not really thought about this before, but it can bring just the opposite of that effect. So Thornton's at the Fitzwilliam Hotel, a high-end Dublin restaurant, lost its Michelin star back in 2015, and it maintained this star for 2 decades. And when it did, profits dropped by 76% by the end of 2016. Yeah, and actually, the place ended up having to close after that. And as the chef, Kevin Thornton, told the Irish Independent, losing the star felt like, quote, getting stabbed in the heart. I mean, it means so much to these people. In fact, one chef, Bernard Loiseau, was so terrified of losing his 3 Michelin stars that it may have actually contributed to his 2003 suicide.
That's really terrible.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, he'd been running this Burgundy restaurant called Le Couture, where he had actually gotten a 3rd Michelin star in 1991. But in 2003, this French newspaper, Le Figaro, published this rumor and claimed that he was slated to lose his 3rd star. And his widow told The Observer that the rumor had a real impact on her husband because he feared that losing a star would have these devastating financial consequences. But one of the saddest parts of the story is after his death, the 2003 Michelin guide gave the restaurant its usual 3 stars.
That is so sad.
It really is. But it's not just losing a star that can have negative consequences for a restaurant. Even getting a star can throw a place into turmoil. So as an example of that, after being listed in the 2016 Hong Kong guide, there was this dessert shop called Kai Kai Dessert that was forced to move because its landlord got greedy. And thinking that it would bring this new spike in business, he raised the rent by 120%.
Which is awful.
Yeah, and the owners did get lucky, though. There was this loyal customer that offered them rent in a nearby space at a rent that he could afford. But the Michelin star branding can be especially tough on small establishments that don't have the capital or the capacity to meet this sudden demand that comes with a rating. Like 72-year-old Jay Fai, who earned a Michelin star in 2017 for her cooking at an open-air street food restaurant in Bangkok. So the award made her this overnight celebrity, which is great, but she was one of only 17 chefs in Thailand with a star. And a few months later, she actually told a reporter she wanted to give the star back.
Can you actually give a star back?
not really, but Fai explained that her restaurant's vibes had been super relaxed before and the star had basically turned it into chaos. I actually feel like I've experienced this before at restaurants when they seem so good and suddenly they gain this notoriety and that experience has just changed.
Totally.
So the award made her this overnight celebrity. She was the only person cooking. So suddenly there was this increase in traffic and it meant she no longer had time to take breaks or chat with her diners that were there. And her servers were overwhelmed from the stress and just worried that neighbors on their street were going to get angry because of the crowds and the noise. But the worst part was that Jay Fai had all these tax inspectors that started showing up, seemingly because they thought she must be making more money than she had reported.
Oh, no.
And they kept trying to look through her books.
So is Jay the only chef who's tried to give these stars back? Have you heard of more of these
Not
cases?
Even close. So there's this South Korean chef, Oya Kwan, that got an Italian eatery called Restaurante O, and it received a Michelin star in 2017. It was a guide to Seoul dining there. And Oh claims that as soon as he learned this, he contacted Michelin and asked to be removed. But it unfortunately didn't work for him. And his restaurant appeared again in 2018 with a star.
So, I mean, I guess there's another way, right? He could just try to lower the quality of the food or the service.
Yeah, I guess so.
But I mean, I guess that's not anything any self-respecting chef wants to do.
Well, in the 2019 edition, Oh actually did lose the star, but he still appeared in the guide, at which point he actually sued Michelin. Not for the demotion, but for including his restaurant at all. There was this CNN interview that he did, and he explained that the guide's methodology was part of the problem. It's the cruelest test in the world, he says. It forces the chefs to work around a year waiting for a test, and they don't know when it's coming.
I mean, I do love that there's this rating system to help guide me as this outsider, especially in cities that I don't know, but you can see how it's hard on chefs.
Yeah.
And also, there have been strange stories that make you question the objectivity and fairness of the organization. Like, apparently Michelin inspectors are supposed to visit a restaurant several times before they rate it. But in 2005, for the first time in history, Michelin was actually forced to recall one of its guides. The 2005 guide covering Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg was pulled after 50,000 copies had already been published. And the reason was that this Belgian restaurant, the Ostend Queen, had been given that Bib Gourmand designation, you know, the one for like great cheap food.
Mm-hmm.
But the restaurant hadn't actually opened yet.
Oops.
So, you know, there's also this issue of investors in the Michelin Guide. The whole thing is a really expensive enterprise. And so, like, you're talking about these big tabs from fine dining restaurants, plus printing up the actual guide. So some Michelin guides are the result of investments from the countries themselves. Michelin guides to Thailand and Singapore and Hong Kong are actually backed in part by payments from the local tourism boards, which totally makes sense. But the sums are pretty impressive. Like, Thailand paid supposedly $4.4 million to be paid out over the course of 5 years to fund like multiple editions of the Michelin Thailand Guide.
That is a lot of money.
Yeah, and corporate sponsors can get involved too. Like, to launch the Hong Kong Guide in 2008, Michelin got funding from several brands, including Evian, Nespresso, Robert Parker Wine Advocate, which Michelin owns a stake in. And while the details are kind of scarce, it kind of makes it hard to verify if government or corporate money is influencing Michelin stars. And if they are, what extent are they actually having their influence met?
I mean, I have to guess this is not zero.
Yeah. I mean, the website Eater connected some of the dots for Michelin's Singapore guide. And so there's this Resorts World Sentosa, and they acted as a title sponsor of the guide and hosted this invitation-only gala for the launch of the 2016 Singapore Stars Guide. And after that, four of the resort's restaurants also happened to snag seven of those coveted stars. So,
I mean, it could be a coincidence. Probably not.
There's also been an issue with Michelin and greenwashing. So in 2020, Michelin added a new designation to the stars and the Bib Gourmand, and they call it the Green Star. Supposedly it honors, quote, restaurants that are role models when it comes to sustainable gastronomy.
So what exactly does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds great, but it's pretty unclear what it actually indicates. So there's this chef, Chris Puglisi, who wrote in this deleted blog now that the Green Star review process consisted of one brief call to his restaurant. There wasn't an in-person audit or a detailed questionnaire. And as he put it, there wasn't even, quote, a critical question of any type. And then there's this other chef, Matt Orlando, who agreed, and he told Wired, "There was absolutely no fact-checking during his Green Star review. I could have said anything, and it would have qualified me for the award."
I'm just shocked by this mango.
So Michelin says, "Our teams rely both on their fieldwork, i.e. on the experience of eating in that restaurant, as well as in-depth research and conversations with restaurateurs regarding their eco-responsible practices." So that's their defense.
I actually didn't think we could get more vague than refined and inspired versus elevated to an art form, but here we are, Mingo.
Yeah, it's a pattern. But the near total secrecy around this review process, especially the process by which stars are given and taken away, means it's kind of impossible to know if Michelin is being fair or what other factors, whether that's money or connections or sponsorship, is actually playing a role. And for diners and chefs, you really don't know if the reviews are done by people familiar with local cuisines.
Right, right. Actually, on that local cuisine tip, it's worth noting that even though in recent years Michelin has expanded coverage beyond Europe and European cooking, some have definitely criticized it for retaining an overly European lens. That South Korean chef Ohye Kwon, the guy who wanted to give his star back, you remember mm-hmm. him, said that the entire Seoul guide was suspect and, quote, a sad joke since it only included 170 of the city's restaurants. So writing in Vogue Korea, one food writer explained, "The only people who really care about having the Michelin guide in Seoul are those who are obsessed with Seoul's international status. Like, they're obsessed with impressing Western elites. They aren't confident that Seoul can stand on its own as a restaurant capital."
So is there a Michelin on other continents?
Well, so far, Michelin's presence in South and Latin America is pretty new and rather limited, and it doesn't seem aware that Africa exists just yet. Somebody should tell them about Africa, I think.
I also noticed that you didn't mention Antarctica.
It's a real snub, to be honest with you. But the research station near this one ice dome supposedly has just the most amazing pupusas.
So they're missing out. Well, before we sign off, maybe we do a quick fact off.
Absolutely.
How about we start with the world's most remote Michelin star restaurant, this two-star restaurant called Cox in Illimanaq, a tiny settlement on Disko Bay in Greenland. The town has a population of 56, but the restaurant staff has brought that up to 88 now. And today it's accessible by boat in the fall and summer. But in the winter and spring, when icebergs clog the bay, you can only get there by helicopter.
Wow. And so what can you get there?
There's a tasting menu that includes more than 20 courses, and it costs about $470 or 3,200 Danish kroner, which I know
you didn't have to do that conversion. Yeah, yeah, I knew.
The food is all locally sourced, and you get dishes like raw whale skin marinated in currant leaf oil, musk ox broth, reindeer tartare with moss and fermented mushroom.
Comfort food.
And ptarmigan with black currant salsa.
Okay. All right. Well, speaking of one of Michelin's cheapest restaurants, back in 2009, the dim sum restaurant Tim Ho Wan opened in Hong Kong and set the world on fire. And within just a year, it received a Michelin star, becoming the world's most inexpensive Michelin-starred restaurant. But almost as quickly, it expanded beyond its humble roots. And today, Tim Ho Wan is a multinational chain with locations in 12 countries, including two where you live in New York City. Which is maybe the best way of dealing with the headache of getting a star. Anyway, Tim Ho Wan Hong Kong no longer has a Michelin star, but it does have the Bib Gourmand designation.
Yeah, I was actually reading about another one of these cheap eats, the Michelin 2016 guide for Singapore, which was their inaugural guide there, gave this star to a street food hawker for the first time. The person's name was Leo Fan. And the restaurant is Hong Kong Soya Sauce Chicken Rice and Noodle. And it also claimed to be the most inexpensive Michelin star restaurant for a while. Its famous soy sauce chicken dish cost about $2. But just like your chef, Tim Ho Wan quickly used that star to open up a slew of franchises.
Yeah, not surprising. So I know we talked about all these chefs trying to give back their stars, but there are plenty who lose stars and desperately want them back, including the French chef Marc Verrat. So in 2019, Verrat lost this lawsuit he brought against Michelin after the guy demoted his restaurant from 3 stars down to 2. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, he wasn't actually asking for the star to be reinstated, but he was trying to get Michelin to provide the names and resumes of the inspectors who graded him, as well as proof that they had in fact eaten at his restaurant. And for their part, Michelin refused, saying they had to protect their inspectors' anonymity, but that the demotion was based on one detail. Verrat used English cheddar in his souffle. I mean, just a big
That's a
problem.
Big mistake.
Yeah, huge,
and it feels
huge,
so
huge
cutting.
Mistake. So for his part, Verrat insisted that he had never done any such thing. And in fact, he showed the court a video of the souffle's preparation. It used 2 French cheeses, Beaufort and Roblochon. And Verrat told CNN, "I'm ready to accept losing a star, but they have to tell me why. In my opinion, they are incompetent. Do you realize they mixed up Roblochon and cheddar? I mean, my God, can you imagine this?" So the court ruled against Verrat, saying there was no proof that he and his business had suffered any damage from the demotion. And to be fair, it does feel like if you've got the sophisticated palate of a Michelin chef, it is hard to mix up cheddar and Roblochon, which is this soft, squishy cheese that kind of looks like brie, or Beaufort, which is basically a type of Gruyere. And I feel like this is probably a conspiracy that we can investigate in a different episode.
Yeah, cheese controversies. Well, I really like that last fact, and I think I'm going to give you today's trophy.
Oh, that's so kind of you. All right, I'm going to place this on Dylan's desk for all of those Pillsbury Doughboys to admire. That's it for today's Part-Time Genius. If you like the show, make sure to tell every single person you know, seriously, every single person. Mm-hmm. But thank you for listening.
Part-Time Genius is a production of Kaleidoscope and iHeartRadio. This show is hosted by Will Pearson and me, Mangesh Hatikler, and researched by our good pal, Mary Phillips Sandy. Today's episode was engineered and produced by the wonderful Dylan Fagan with support from Tyler Klang. The show is executive produced for iHeart by Katrina Norvell and Ali Perry, with social media support from Sasha Gay Trustee, Dara Potts, and Vaini Shori. For more podcasts from Kaleidoscope and iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.